This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Bush's No Child Left Behind Act required schools to provide student names, addresses, and phone numbers to military recruiters in order to receive federal funding. It's one of many changes to military recruitment over the years as the nation's armed forces struggle to retain and draw in new recruits. That struggle shows up in the numbers. The Pentagon reported that last year only about 3 in 10 Americans aged 17 to 24 were actually fit for military service. Combine that with the nation's too long and increasingly unpopular wars, and recruiters are searching for new ways to meet quotas. Today, Where We Live, we'll talk to two researchers studying these changes, including the increased use of video games in military recruitment. Later, we'll hear from a documentary producer who spent time with the children of active duty military, finding out how they learn and what happens when parents go overseas. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. You can always find us at WNPR.org/Where We Live. Our first guest is Kenny Dibner, who's Research Associate at Policy Studies Associates in Washington, D.C. She's been studying military recruitment for years, and I welcome you to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, how did you get started studying this particular world of military recruitment?
It's sort of a funny story. I was doing some research. I was interested in the practice in the U.S. Senate of attaching something called a non-germane rider to a piece of legislation. So a rider or an amendment to a bill that's totally unrelated to the content of the bill at hand, that's designed to sort of slip a policy objective under the rug, or get it passed without too much attention. And in the process of doing that studying, I came across the language for what will ultimately become Section 9528, which is the part of No Child Left Behind, which details schools' responsibilities vis-a-vis military recruiting and receiving federal funds. And I was blown away. I was blown away by, first of all, the language of the amendment, but also that I knew nothing about the ways in which the military was integrated into American schools. I knew nothing about the structure. And so I started to do some preliminary research and found that nobody knew anything about this thing, that it was not a big deal. And given how controversial military recruiting in schools is, I sort of assumed that it would be a much more popular topic for academics to sort of sink their teeth into. And when you're in graduate school and looking for something to write a dissertation on, and there's not a ton of work in some place, and you feel like you could potentially talk about it for a couple of years, then you just jump on it and don't think twice.
And so you had a sort of a wow moment that I think maybe many people even listening to our show right now may be having, which is,
yeah.
So we're tying federal funding of schools to allowing military recruiters access to information. Give us a little bit more detail. What sort of information are we talking about here?
So in 2001, as part of No Child Left Behind, a section of the legislation, which is called Section 9528, was included. And what that meant was, if you are a school which receives, a high school which receives any kind of federal financial support, you have to open your doors to military recruiters in the same capacity that you would any other post-secondary opportunity. So if you have a college fair, that means that you need to allow military recruiters into the college fair. You need to give them a booth. If you let college, college agents come in and talk to students during classroom hours, give them informational sessions, then military recruiters have to be able to do the same thing. If you let colleges table in the cafeteria, then military recruiters need to be able to do the same thing. So that kind of access was sort of unprecedented. And beyond that, every school is responsible for giving to the military a directory of their students' information. That includes students' names, home addresses, and phone numbers. Schools can design an opt-out process in that directory. So you can send forms home for parents to fill out that say that they don't want their students to be included in that kind of a directory, and then your student isn't included and won't be contacted by a recruiter.
So let's get to that second part second. This whole idea of a directory of student information is something that is, well, it's fascinating and maybe a little bit creepy. But that first part where you would expect that military recruiters would have the same access as college recruiters at a college fair, a lot of people would hear that, Kenny, and just say, well, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Let's give students an opportunity to find out about the full range of things that might be their next step. Military is just one of those things.
Yeah. I mean, I think it sort of depends on where you land on war, generally, as to how you feel about that. But one of the things that I found was that schools' missions really mattered for how schools treated and experienced the military in their buildings. So, if a school was an expressly college preparatory school, the military sometimes had a much tougher time integrating itself, because necessarily, if the sole goal for all of the students in attendance is going to college, then the military really complicates achieving that goal. And in that case, they really were not as welcome. On the other hand, there are a lot of schools for whom general preparedness is the goal, this idea of being prepared for anything you want to do in a post-secondary environment. And in that case, the military was often a much more common and understood enterprise.
We're talking with Dr. Kenny Dibner, who's a research associate at Policy Studies Associates. She's been studying the changes in military recruitment over the years, including access of military recruiters on high school campuses. If you'd like to join us with thoughts or questions, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Now let's get to the second piece that this legislation had that you discussed. This directory of student information, how different is that than the information that schools give up to, say, private or public colleges about their students? Is it entirely different, or is it the same sort of information?
Well, I mean, I think the difference is that with public and private colleges, schools have an option. So they can choose to give out that information or not, depending on what the administrator wants or what the policy of a district is. But that's not the case if you're accepting federal funds, which the vast majority of high schools in the United States are. So the locus of control is different.
Have schools actually been denied funding because they've decided to push back against some of these rules since the No Child Left Behind rules went into effect?
There isn't an example of a school being denied funding, although many schools have been threatened with denial of funds.
So how did it work beforehand, before these legal changes went into place as part of a small provision in No Child Left Behind, obviously one that not a whole lot of people paid attention to? What was it like beforehand? Was this a much different process as far as access?
Yeah, it really was a very different process. I mean, we've been moving in this direction for the last 20 years or so. The military, not in education legislation, but in defense legislation, we've been compelling schools to give up student information for a long time. It's just that this was the first time that it was really it was incorporated in sort of the education wheelhouse, and that really is a game changer. Before this moment, administrators could decide what they wanted to do with the military. It was up to the individual principals. Desires and whims whether or not the military could come in, and now that's not the case. But one of the interesting things I heard from administrators was that actually the law and having the process of the law has meant that now there's not sort of the push and pull between recruiters and administrators in the same way as there used to be. So administrators felt that before, recruiters would constantly be knocking on their doors, trying to come in and trying to talk to students. And now there's a predetermined process. You have to give the directory. Students have the opportunity to opt out of the directory, but there's not this kind of constant push and pull.
Of course, you say that this has changed a lot over the last 20 years, and over these last 20 years, we've been fighting some very long, increasingly unpopular wars that have sent a lot of young people into harm's way. How much of this change do you think comes down to the fact that it's been harder for the military to actually recruit? We gave these numbers at the top of the program, Kenny, that you know, only about 3 in 10 Americans 17 to 24 are actually fit to serve, according to the military. It means that the military seems to be fishing in a much smaller pool of potential applicants. Is this all due to their need to hit certain targets, make certain quotas?
Absolutely. I mean, it's absolutely what's going on. And in fact, if you look at some of the sort of supporting information, the conversations that were happening on the floor of the Senate in this, you know, in the moment that this part of the legislation was being considered, it's actually really quite unusual. There are senators saying, you know, we don't have enough people to serve and we can't get into schools and we need a way to do that. We need a mechanism for getting into schools. So that was definitely on the minds of everyone, you know, including Donald Rumsfeld, who, you know, there's evidence of an email that he sent to that effect.
I want to bring into the conversation Corey Mead, who's an associate professor of English at Baruch College in New York, who's the author of War Play. Coming up in the next segment, we're going to be talking a bit about how the military is using video games in recruitment. But Corey Mead, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into some of what you've researched around video games, I guess I'm wondering if you can comment on these changes that Dr. Dibner has been outlining so far. I mean, do you see this as part of a larger trend in American military recruitment?
To a certain extent, I think the issue with the military, though, is the difference between getting into certain high schools, especially in certain states, rather than colleges. And with certain high schools, part of the trick with learning with using video games is to get around places where they're not actually allowed access, where you have to be 17 before the Army is allowed to talk to you or the other military branches. So there's a two-pronged assault. The first that your guest is talking about on the upper levels, and then the second is how do we get around certain bans on getting to kids who are younger, 12 and 13 and so on.
I'm wondering, Dr. Dibner, before I let you go, one of the targets, certainly, of military recruiters has been kids who come from more disadvantaged economic circumstances. That's not a new thing, right? The idea of the military as a way to be able to make a career for yourself if you come from a place where college might not necessarily be your first option, that's been around for as long as the American military has been around. How have you seen that part of it change? Has there been any specific targeting of lower-income students with some of what you've studied?
Yeah, so the most effective tool that the military has in schools is the GI Bill, which hasn't been around since as long as the American military has been around, but is an incredibly important tool which enables the military to it gives the military a certain kind of relevance in school standings by allowing an opportunity to or saying that they will pay for college if you commit a certain term of service. So that is sort of a game changer. And paying for college for kids who might not otherwise have access to money for college makes the military a much more attractive option than it would be, you know, with otherwise. You know, I think the issue of targeting is something that administrators and educators are really, really aware of. Every administrator I spoke to, every educator I spoke to, was highly aware that there is an idea that the military is targeting students of color and poor students, and that there wouldn't be that access if they weren't able to dangle the carrot of college attendance in front of students. So it really is a very complicating factor in the process.
Corey Mead, does that resonate with some of what you've studied? Is there a certain target group for the military using some of these new tactics to recruit?
Yeah, in that case, the target group is students with specific skills or interests, ideally centered around STEM skills, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. And so the same kinds of kids that are good at playing contemporary video games are the kind of students they want in the military today because of things like the ability to switch channels rapidly between different streams of communication and information. So part of the video game goal is not just getting bodies in the military, but getting certain kinds of bodies.
Dr. Dibner, you talk about the GI Bill and the promise of a college education. Sometimes the promise of learning transferable skills that allow you to then go on in the workplace later on. as we found, that's not necessarily the case, right?
Yeah, it's definitely part of the pitch, but it hasn't really panned out. In fact, the military's own data on the employment of their vets is not super promising. I think there are leadership skills that are are associated with military service, but they exist in a very specific code. There's a certain kind of language of leadership that doesn't always translate in today's more open and fast-paced and collaborative working environments.
A last thing for you, Doctor. No Child Left Behind it has been controversial since the start, and not necessarily because of this provision, but because of many provisions that have states wondering whether or not they want the federal funding that comes along with some of the rules and oversight that the federal government is putting down. Has there been pushback specifically on this provision from any of the states?
I don't know of states specifically saying that, we don't want your funds because of this thing. I do know of a lot of schools who are individually saying, we don't need this money. It's not worth it to us. I don't have an example of a school actually not taking the money, because I think there are ways to structure the opt-out process so that military recruiters don't have access to your students' data. We saw many examples of schools who would include opt-out forms in a packet of forms that had to get signed and returned to a central office at the beginning of the year. And when that's the case, parents are just signing a whole myriad of forms, and then there's no database to turn over to the military, and as a result, recruiters aren't interested in your school.
Dr. Kenny Dibner is Research Associate at Policy Studies Associates in Washington, who's been studying military recruitment. Thank you so much for the interesting work and for spending some time with us here on Where We Live. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was a real privilege.
When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Corey Mead, who's the author of War Play. We'll talk more about the use of video games in military recruitment. We'll also be talking with the documentary producer later this hour, who's been studying what happens with kids who are left behind at military bases, how they learn, and what exactly is happening while their parents are serving overseas. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, we're talking with researchers who've been taking a look at military recruitment. Aside from controversial tactics used in schools, the military has branched out from traditional strategies and using more social media and video games for training and recruitment. America's Army, a training and combat video game, has become one of the top five most popular online video games ever since its creation back in 2002. The use of virtual reality in video games has been proven to treat mental and physical conditions. It's also a good way to train and expose military to simulations of real-life situations. But does recruiting with games make America's youth associate war with gaming? Does it make light of something that should be treated much more seriously? You can join us with your thoughts and questions at 860-275-7266. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Our guest today is Corey Mead, an associate professor of English at Baruch College in New York. Corey Mead has been studying the use of military and video games, including with a book called War Play. So you set this up for us a little bit in the first segment, but maybe you can just explain a little bit specifically how the military uses video games right now to recruit, especially very young kids.
Well, there's been a bit of a change. It started in the early 2000s, actually developed in the late 1990s, where the Army developed a specific video game, the game America's Army you talked about, which was as good as any of the commercial video games, high-quality commercial video games, but they released it free. And it was basically a game that took you through the basic training process and then guided you to any of the several jobs you could do if you actually joined the military. And by releasing it for free, their goal was to get it into the space of specifically 12 and 13-year-old kids who wouldn't be allowed to be recruited in schools. If they had this game, it could get around not only school boards and teachers, but also parents, and be beamed directly into the kids' own bedrooms. And so it was the first, and it was very successful. For a good 6 years, it was one of the top 10 online games. And in more recent years, as the America's Army itself, the online video game, hasn't been as popular, they've been using the same scenarios and graphics and other things developed for America's Army and repurposing it into different programs that go into actual curriculum in public schools. So, for example, it's bundled with, there's a nonprofit content provider called Project Lead the Way, and that's pre-approved in all 50 states around the country by the state school boards. And so America's Army partnered with them so that they didn't have to get approved to be in the schools. It was pre-approved through Project Lead the Way, but the actual content of what was being provided for these educational classes, sorry, these engineering classes and et cetera, was from the game America's Army.
Okay, so this is making its way directly into schools, but primarily what this has been is a video game tool, and the idea is that video games are going to draw kids in. It's going to hopefully, from the military's point of view, get people excited about doing this sort of work, but also maybe help identify people who are really, really good at it?
Exactly. It's not just to get, like I said before, they want to get people excited about the military. They specifically want to get people who have these so-called STEM skills, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. They want them to be excited to be in the military because it's such a technologically advanced environment these days in modern warfare. They want those kids because they feel that those are the skills that are going to make kids successful on today's battlefields.
Of course, the psychology behind video games is something that's really important, and we've been covering this an awful lot over the course of the last decade or so. There's science kind of on both sides, Corey Mead, that suggests in some ways that video games can cause violent behavior. In other studies, it's said that it has little impact at all. What do you know about how the use of video games, specifically first-person shooter games or games that that help to simulate warfare in some way, how much they actually change people's psychological makeup, change their patterns of behavior? Do we know much about that?
I mean, like you said, the studies are conflicting often. The general consensus of what we know seems to be that if video games can pump up aggressive feelings, specifically the first-person shooters, the question is how long after you play does it linger, right? Is it for 20 minutes or half an hour after you play a game, or is there a longer-term impact? And that's something that researchers are not decided on at all.
We have a phone call from Everett in West Hartford, and if you want to join us at 860-275-7266, you can, as we talk about military recruitment and video games. Everett, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, John. I think it's a great topic that you're talking about. I am full-time in the military. I do have children, two of whom I've discussed about joining the military. Their mother has served in the military. So we're a military family. And some of the people I respect most in my life have very distinguished military careers. So when you talk to your children about what their aspirations are in life, it's not unreasonable to talk to your child in junior high or the freshman or sophomore year of high school as saying, what should they be doing if they're interested in a career in the military? Any more than those parents who may aspire to have their children go to an Ivy League school, they're addressing those issues with their children to make decisions at a very young age. So it's not necessarily fair to, you know, ostracize the military for wanting to bring that decision-making process to a younger student. I agree with is you shouldn't be using something that a lot of people, even within the military, feel is not a positive aspect for a child. And a lot of these first-person video shooter games, most parents rightfully don't want their children involved with.
Everett, I'd love to ask you a follow-up question. I really appreciate your phone call and your perspective on this, because that's, I think, at the heart of some of Corey Mead's work is this sense that I think we all want to expect that the U.S. military should be able to recruit people who have a wide variety of interests, maybe some of whom could get into Ivy League schools but want to join the military to do any number of things, but that the association of military service specifically with war and shooting people is part of the problem. You seem to have an issue with that, too. Is there a better way to maybe get across the message to young people about what military life and service is like other than, you know, you're going to go to someplace like Iraq and Afghanistan and get to shoot people, which is an awful lot of what people see in these video games?
Well, anyone who talks to somebody in the military, and it's very difficult not to discount what someone does at, you know, the doctorate research level, but are these people talking to people who have successful careers in the military? Because anyone who's been in the military will tell you, other than being on that deployment, the military has many qualities that just are really solid for any American citizen. And you can't just say that military is all war, and if you have, you know, moral or ethical reasons against war, that therefore you should just exclude the military from anything, you know, you would discuss, because they're the ones who fight our wars.
Everett, I really appreciate your phone call. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Corey Mead, I'm wondering if you have a response or a thought about what he had to say, because clearly one of the things we want to get at is what has the impact been of some of these tactics, whether the first piece of research that we talked about you know, military getting into high schools and having access to young people maybe in an earlier age, some of the work that you've done around video games. Do we know anything about the outcomes of this and what happens to some of the students who decide they will want to get into the military? I guess I'm just wondering if you could respond to our caller, Everett.
Well, evidence is a bit anecdotal because there aren't too many people who would be like, yeah, I played this video game and I thought it was so awesome that I went and joined the military. People didn't want to say that. I'd say there's a couple different things here. The first point that the caller makes about the military should have equal access as any other corporation or whatever else, I think is a fair point. I think the issue when it comes to schools, but my only problem with it is the same problem I have with companies like Coca-Cola or whoever else putting their brand into student textbooks, which is like looking at a school-age population within the confines of school as a target population to get your brand into is something that I'm not too thrilled with. The larger issue he talks about of having the military be an equally considered career as anything else is an excellent point. And it's one that's coming up more now when it comes to the military's real push now, especially around video games, is for cyber defenders or cyber warriors, as they call them. And the issue they're facing there is if you have kids who have the kinds of skills that are good for cybersecurity, why would they join the military when they can make God knows how much more money joining a corporation, right? So the military's big push now with games and the like is how to get kids who have cyber skills interested in joining something like Cyber Command as opposed to going to whatever corporation will pay them much better.
And that's got to be a fascinating and very hard pull for the military, given the amount of money that's out there for in the private sector, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they're using new tactics now, not just games in the classroom, which they're doing, but also things like cyber competition, right? How do we get people who like these skills to look at it in a sort of competitive way as a place where you get to do things with your skill, cyber skills, that you wouldn't get to do for a corporation?
I want to get to another quick phone call here. Keith is calling from Middlefield. Hello, Keith. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, John. How you doing? Love the show.
Thank you.
And I was just calling in regards to the individual who was speaking about the video games.
Yeah.
And how it's like a first-person shooter and I was in the military, and I have a master's degree in education, and I served overseas, and I was in the so-called combat arms, which is 10% of the military, the Army.
Yeah.
I just want to say that a lot of times we get caught up in what the 10% do, but we don't see what the 90% of the military does. And you could even look to the events that are going on today over in Nepal, where a lot of the military search and rescue teams are going over to help out the people.
Well, and I think, Keith, I really appreciate your phone call. That's what I think I was getting at with Everett, and maybe I'd like to ask you this as well. The fact of the matter is that people do get caught up in what the 10% do, and that group that gets caught up in it is video game designers, a lot of people who market first-person shooter games, mm-hmm. maybe even recruiters. They want kids to believe that what the military is all about is going into harm's way and walking around with a gun, potentially shooting people. It seems, though, the military, the public and video game makers are all complicit in giving the impression that that's what the military does when, as you say, an awful lot of them are fighting cybercrime and they're also helping out after an earthquake. How do we change that, Keith?
I think what happens is that 10% is the hardest group to get people to do, because when an individual in high school goes looking for future jobs, they see the stuff where like aerospace engineering and so forth and so on. And we had people in my unit that one of my battalion commanders had a master's degree in aerospace engineering. And, I mean, these are not jobs that people can go out and do in the non-civilian or the civilian world and come out with the same benefits. But I think we need to focus more on the 90% of the people and
try
to get these other people to do jobs that are more difficult.
Keith, thank you very much for that. I really appreciate it. And Corey Mead, you touched on that. I think that that's really the key here. So much of what we talk about when we talk about video games really is about trying to get people excited about the idea of actual warfare. And there's clearly so many issues with that. But both of our callers seem to suggest that we need somehow to be able to express that there's a lot more to the military than just shooting people.
Well, it's not quite accurate that the military's use of video games has been to try to get people excited about shooting people. Part of the military's effort with video games, a large part, was to point out exactly what that caller just said, which is that, you know, if you join the Army, for example, there are over 200 occupations you can do, a small percentage of which involve being on the battlefield and shooting people. So that was a big part of the effort to appeal to teenagers, is like, let's rewrite your vision of what a military career entails. So that is indeed how they've been used.
But I will say that the military doesn't exactly turn down the free publicity that comes with Call of Duty.
Oh, no, it's a happy accident. You know, the video game industry emerged out of military funding and context, and now they get sort of this free benefit of these incredibly popular video games that put out a very positive version of the military.
Corey Mead, the last thing for you. Does anything change now that these two very long and costly wars are about at their conclusion? We've had a lot of deployments, and this has been the first time we fought wars like this with a fully voluntary military in a very, very long time. Do you see any changes in this world forthcoming?
Specifically in terms of recruitment, the changes are all around what I mentioned before, which is cyber war, cyber defenders. So how are we going to get kids involved in the military for this next new aspect of warfare? And that's the key issue, and it will be the key issue for, I think, several years, if not decades, going forward.
Corey Mead is an associate professor of English at Brooke College in New York. He's also the author of War Play. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we're going to be talking about a population that is drawn into military service in their own way. It's the children of active duty military. Documentary producer Kavitha Cardoza talked with students and teachers about this world. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, there's been a push in schools to rethink the idea of punishment. Zero tolerance policies have led to school arrests, suspensions, and expulsions, all outcomes that are not tied to better learning. We'll take a look at new initiatives in the New Haven public school system aimed at change. Hope you can join our conversation tomorrow. Today we're talking about military recruitment and the effects of military culture, especially on children. We turn now to Kavitha Cardoza's Military Children, part of a documentary series called Breaking Ground, which chronicles what happens to the children left behind when a parent goes overseas. There are millions of children with parents in the military. They live on military bases around the globe and in cities and towns all over the U.S., and they move around a lot, an average of 9 times before graduating high school. Some are able to attend Department of Defense schools. Others are stuck in a public school system that doesn't always cater to their emotional or academic needs. The children of active duty military, of course, also deal with another issue, the trauma of having parents who come back changed from long deployments. Today we'll ask, how are children affected by their parents' struggles to readjust to civilian life? You can join us at 860-275-7266. Kavitha Cardoza is the host and executive producer of Breaking Ground, a documentary series at WAMU Public Radio in Washington, D.C., and she joins us once again on the program. Kavitha, welcome back to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
You start your documentary saying that you didn't know very much about this world of military children going in, despite the fact that you've studied and looked at education for years. Tell me some of the things that surprised you as you began your reporting.
I was very surprised, John, to know how, first of all, how many children there were. There are about 2 million children. That's a large population of children that, you know, I just, when I Googled, did research, I just couldn't find any articles in the popular media about them. I had to look up a lot of academic papers. I think I was very surprised by how frequently they move, up to 9 times before high school graduation. I was surprised how frequently their parents were deploying and what that meant to them. Over the past decade, it's been particularly stressful. And I was very surprised by the stress when parents come back and that reintegration, as well as when they don't come back at all. So I heard everything from, I miss them terribly and I cannot concentrate on work because I'm constantly wondering whether they're safe, to my dad was never around, to I had to do lots of extra chores every time my father went for training or overseas.
You, of course, take a look at really the two different Americas that exist around the military, the kind of America that exists here in Connecticut, say, where there are pockets of active duty military, certainly around the sub base and some other places. But for the most part, we don't have a culture of military service. You probably don't know that many people in our state who actually do serve. But you also went to places where the entire population is around a military base. So you have thousands of people in a very large place, say, in North Carolina, where almost everyone is tied to the military. How do these two places, these two Americas, Kavitha, differ in the ways that the children learn and, I guess, grow up with military parents?
Mm-hmm. One thing I found, John, was that these children, when they when their parents leave active duty, then they might be in civilian communities like Hartford, you know. But the issues they bring or the experiences they've had as military children continue. I found that friends were a big deal. You know, children want their friends. And when you're moving every 2 years, either they found it difficult to make friends or some of them just didn't want to make friends because they knew they were going to be moving on. There were just physical kind of differences in the place. So I met one child who was in Hawaii for 4 years, and then she moved in the middle of winter to Virginia. She was like, I'm used to wearing tank tops and flip-flops to school, and it's so laid back. And suddenly in Virginia, it's like snow. She didn't know what had hit her. Academics, I mean, you can imagine, say, you're a child in Connecticut and you're a senior and you've done certain history credits, and then you move to Texas and none of those credits are going to be recognized because it's something completely different. So that has been something that has been very challenging for kids, as well as cultural factors. So a lot of these military children, John, they live overseas. And so one child told me, you know, someone in her rural school, stateside in the U.S., said, oh, what's your favorite food to eat on her first day of school? And she had just come back from Korea. Her parents had been there for 3 years. She said seaweed. And this child said, ugh, seaweed? And so she said, I felt terrible. I felt like I was the odd one out. So it's just a combination of these factors.
We're talking with Kavitha Cardoza. She's a reporter and executive producer of the series Breaking Ground at WAMU. Her documentary is about military children, the children of active duty U.S. military. And it takes a full look at these lives, as you can imagine, that may be quite a bit different than many of our listeners. If you have experiences, though, either as an active duty parent or as the child of a military parent, we'd like to hear from you at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Of course, the deployment overseas of parents is something that has a huge impact on children. Let's listen to a bit from your documentary.
As much as we went through it on a map, this is where Daddy is. You know, he's over the Atlantic Ocean. He's over here. He said, Daddy's lost. And, you know, that broke. It still hurts because he'll be deploying again.
He's going to be deploying again?
Yeah, shortly. And it takes a toll on the families.
You can hear in her voice it does take a toll. Can you tell us a bit more about that story and what you learned about some of the impact on children whose parents are serving overseas?
Sure. That was Jeanette, and I met her in North Carolina. And the conversation started, he went to a Department of Defense school, which are schools on bases set up for these military children. And she was career military, but she said she just couldn't understand why her son would keep saying his stomach was hurting. And then she took him to school and mentioned it to a teacher. And because they're so used to this population, they said, oh, that's really common. You know, he's missing his dad. He's worried. But he doesn't know how to say that. And so it's kind of manifesting psychosomatically. And then they talked to him and he felt better. But, you know, that's the children. And then you also, you could, like you said, you could hear it in the mother's voice, how hard it was. She had three little boys, raising them almost like a single parent when her husband was overseas. So that was very, very stressful. And I heard that story from, I don't know, dozens and dozens of families, John.
Was there a big difference in the way schools were able to cope with a behavior issue like that or a health issue like that, depending on whether or not they were located in a military base or located in more of a civilian population?
I definitely thought so. You know, in the Department of Defense schools, they're very specialized. They're working with a specialized population, and the teachers have specific training in how to talk to children right from the, you know, pre-K little ones to the seniors in high school, how to talk to them about their parents leaving, how to recognize signs like a tummy hurting, they had little, like, pictures that the little ones could kind of identify their emotions. They could do certain things. They had books, John, like My Mommy is My Hero, and it was all about a mom who was deploying overseas. So they were very set up to deal with this population. They're also very standardized in terms of teacher training, in terms of the curriculum, in terms of the amount of money they get. They're on base, so parents can walk them, or they can walk or cycle to class. You know, it just makes them feel like, I think, the school and the teachers have their arms wrapped around them.
And it seems as though from your reporting that these Department of Defense schools, they have a lot of the resources. We heard from teachers who said they had almost unlimited budgets to buy supplies, teachers who clearly were well compensated and who'd been in these Department of Defense run schools for quite some time. But are there changes coming, Kavitha, because the money necessary to keep up the entire military infrastructure seems to always be on a razor's edge? Are these DOD schools that have been seemingly so successful, are they changing now?
Yes, they are. In fact, John, there's a study by the RAND Corporation, and we're still awaiting the results, which we're looking at every single school, to Department of Defense school, to see whether it should remain open. So education, even though it's one of the top priorities for military families when deciding whether to stay in the military or where to relocate to, their children's education is really a priority, except the Department of Defense, not everyone agrees that it is the primary function or one of the primary functions of the military. And so in the past, I think since 2006, approximately 50 DOD schools have been closed. And so the RAND Corporation was looking at each one of them to see whether they should remain open, whether the children could go to a nearby public school, or in some cases now what's becoming more popular is charter schools on bases. So they're independently operated, but they are on base, so you get some of the advantages.
One of the things I found interesting in your report about the military schools is often these were schools that were unionized, but the teachers' union actually got along quite well with the folks who were running the school, something that doesn't always happen out in the rest of the world. Do you see some big changes coming if indeed some of these schools get turned into charters? Does the nature of the relationship between teachers and administration change?
Oh, definitely that'll change, because with charter schools, I mean, there is no union, and that's part of their kind of selling point, that you can get rid of teachers who are underperforming, or you can run it very much like not so much a business, but, you know, they call their top people CEOs. You know, it is run kind of like a business where accountability is a big deal. Whereas, yes, these teachers, I mean, it was fascinating to me to see all the issues we talk about in the civilian world. How in military schools, I mean, they were doing really well with unionized teachers. There was such a level of respect. And I have to say, John, that these children do very, very well academically. They are on par with the top states. They have unionized teachers, which in the civilian world is seen as the root of all problems with education sometimes. So yes, it'll be very interesting.
I wanted to play one last clip from your documentary, Breaking Ground, Military Children. We've been talking about children who are dealing with parents who are away, but sometimes they're also dealing with parents who come back very changed and sometimes even worse. Let's listen.
He died because, like, his brain got messed up and he got mad a lot, and he accidentally, he accidentally shot himself.
I see Susan shaking her head, but Connor continues talking. He says when he thinks about his dad, sometimes he's happy, sometimes he's sad, and sometimes he's angry. Susan says dealing with questions from Connor was the most difficult, and there were many questions.
But how did he die? And I gritted my teeth, you know, and basically said he took his own life. But how? And I said, with a gun. And he looked at me and he goes, he shot himself? Why? And I said, I don't know.
Oh, my goodness. Kavitha, it's very, very hard to listen to. But that conversation about how you talk to a child about a suicide of a parent after coming back from war, obviously this is one of many, many, many stories. But what did you take away from this story?
God, it was heartbreaking, John. You know, even listening to his little baby voice, and I feel so awful. This was a mother, Susan, and she had two little boys, and that was Connor. Part of the challenge is, John, that there's a camp called TAPS Camp, which is very, very popular, and it's for children whose parents have died in the wars. And so they are taught to see their parents as heroes. They are, you know, they have kind of activities where they understand it. Well, part of the challenges with suicide is that these children feel that their parents were not heroes. There's kind of some kind of embarrassment, and they feel they shouldn't talk about it, you know, because they didn't die in war. It's almost like I would sit in on these camps and you'd hear people say, oh, my dad died with an AK-47 and my dad died in a tank accident. And you know, it's very hard for these children. They don't know how to understand, well, my dad killed himself. And then why did he leave me? Didn't he love me enough? And there's so many of these conflicting emotions. It's also indicative, I think, John, of the transition back to civilian life. So the husband was an excellent marksman, had done very, very well in the career. And, you know, the leadership skills, the getting things done, accountability, all those great things you learn in the military, he felt did not translate into the civilian world. And he applied for so many jobs and couldn't get it, anything. And so he got more and more kind of despondent that, oh, during the wars, he was seen as this hero and everyone, you know, really, you know, honored his work. And then he felt the civilian population didn't, and it was a very hard transition, and that's something Susan felt was at the root of the suicide.
We just have about 30 seconds left, Kavitha, but the supports needed for parents and children with so many military personnel coming back with PTSD and similar problems, do you feel like they're there, that the military is getting there in providing these services?
I think that they're getting there. I think there are services. I think a lot more needs to be done to tell parents and students about it. I'm watching the schools to see what's going to happen with Department of Defense schools, because that's a very, very supportive environment for children. And civilians as well. I think it's our responsibility to welcome these families back and to help in their transition.
Kavitha Cardoza is executive producer of Breaking Ground, Military Children. She produces her documentaries for WAMU Public Radio in Washington, D.C., where she joined us from today. Kavitha, thank you so much for your reporting and your great work here. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, John.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kylan Wolf. Today's show is produced with help from Sydney Lauro. Thank you, Sydney. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer is Katie Tlarski. Thanks also to our intern, Julia Pistel. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to wnpr.org/where we live. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.